my father being oblivious to that. But I think as a consequence, since they had failed, actually, and I say that reservedly, they'd actually failed to convey the beauty and the meaning mm-hmm. of their faith to us, that none of us have strong feelings about our Judaism. My feelings weaken as the years go by, as I see more tragedy in this world and think less of religion as a whole, although it might be a worse world if we didn't have it.
But your friends were mostly, were they from Bikaholim, or were they, or
no, primarily they were primarily from school. I remember we had a circle of immediate friends in high school, and we were so close that we'd meet before school began, we'd meet between classes in the hall, and our lives revolved around this little circle of friends. And I can remember when boys started to mean more to us than they had in the past. If we ever wanted to have an engagement with boys, girls had to give a party. So we'd have a series of parties. The girl would fill in the dance programs, and we'd get dressed in long dresses. The boys didn't get dressed up, however.
Where were these parties?
In our respective homes.
Uh-huh.
And never was such a thing as wine or liquor. Of course, there was prohibition during much of that time, but we were all very law-abiding, uh-huh. and the social mores, unconsciously, you just didn't do things.
Right.
I didn't know anybody who was a delinquent. We all did what our parents expected of us. And the one thing that's vivid in my mind is that invariably at these parties, the refreshments were cake and milk.
Mm-hmm.
And I can remember many times going bicycling or something with the boys, and we always came back and had cake and milk at my mother. She always had chocolate cake on the weekends. And another vivid memory is during the Depression, Harry Pass, who later became a practicing physician in Seattle, would occasionally get his father's car. And we were all in high school. Nobody had any money. And I can remember Harry's driving up, maybe six of us would pile into Harry's father's car, and he'd drive up to the gas station and hold his hand up, fill her up, and hold up one finger. And gas was 20 cents a gallon. If the boys had as much as 25 cents, and it was a summer evening, we used to go down to Leschi and rent canoes. Mm-hmm. And that was a big night. When I went off to college, the same circle of boys who were my friends in high school came here to the University of Washington, and these friendships continued very closely.
Uh-huh.
Very stable group. Everybody knew they had to study, but socially we still went out, but still nobody had any money in those days, and so
did
we
you,
made our own.
Where did you live, at home? Or?
Well, I lived at home, and I can remember Merle Cohn, who's been active in Anti-Defamation League and a practicing attorney, and I, the only one I knew who owned his own car, was Billy Topp, who later became Dr. Topp, and his mother had bought him a Model T.
Mm-hmm.
And Billy lived over on Cherry, around 32nd or so, and he would pick up Merle Cohn, who was also an active practicing attorney these past years in Seattle, and then he'd come down and pick me up, and we'd go through the Arboretum to the university, and we paid Billy 25 cents a week, each of us, to drive us to campus,
uh-huh.
because the streetcar fare, where I had to transfer twice to get to campus, was a nickel at that time. When I went to high school, the streetcar fare was 2.5 cents. However, Billy got the 2 bits, and then I have to come home transferring several times to get to Denny Blaine from the university campus.
Yes.
But other people did it, so today I regard it as a horrible hardship, but at that time you just accepted
sure,
it.
Sure. Times were different.
Right. To continue about my own immediate family, At any rate, when I worked at the Civil Service Administration during the war, several early newcomers to Seattle who had the foresight to leave Germany before many others boarded me, and my eventual husband was among those who came. I think he and Dr. Hans Lehmann were the two earliest coming in 1936. A friend of mine asked me to have a blind date with him, and as a favor to him, I did go. He was so different from the American boys with whom I went, very gallant, as most Europeans
were. For the record, this was Walter, of
this
course.
This was Walter.
And what was his name at that time? Was it Lowenthal?
He came here with a passport that said Lowenthal, L-O-E-W-E-N-T-H-A-L. Mm-hmm. But he wanted to anglicize it and went to court and had it changed to Lowen, L-O-W-E-N, by which we've since been known. At any rate, he was much older than I, since he was not a contemporary. 12 years older to be exact. My parents objected to the age difference, and particularly because he was of German extraction. Mm-hmm. One of the prejudices that they had, and it was quite general among Europeans who came to this country from Eastern Europe as compared to those Europeans mm-hmm. who came to this country from Germany. Temple de Hirsch had been established by a strong German educated element, and regarded themselves socially, and of course they were economically superior to those Jews who came from Eastern Europe. And Walter, my date at that time, represented the German culture Jew. At any rate, they objected strenuously to him, but I guess being a strong-willed young woman, after turning him down a number of times, he always knew how to make a very nice date, and because he worked for a living, he didn't have much money, but he had more than the other boys, and he skied, and he started me skiing, and Sunday night always meant dinner out. Eventually learned to care for him deeply and had a very satisfying and good marriage.
Yeah.
At the time, most women did not continue.
When did you get married then?
We got married in 1939. My parents strongly objected. So my sister accompanied us, and we went to California. Married by a very charming conservative rabbi, Dr. Rabbi Sol White.
Oh, yes.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. And I must admit, my parents didn't harbor any negative feelings when we came home. They accepted Walter and learned to love him. And he was more considerate and kinder to them than their own sons were.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. He really was such a decent human being.
And we had two children. And
we had two children, and at that time when you had kids, you stayed home with them. You didn't go off to work. So my life revolved around the children. And when Howard was about 12 years old, he went to Temple de Hirsch. We never felt an intimacy, and since I would have to admit was about the religious aspect of Judaism, even though I felt ethnically, mm-hmm. And the people was indicated by Mordechai Kaplan in Reconstructionism, I felt strongly, I felt my Jewishness strongly.
Mm-hmm.
But less so from a religious point of view.
How did your family, we're digressing a little bit, but yeah. How did your family feel about Zionism, or how did you feel about it?
Well, at that time Israel did not exist,
mm-hmm.
Nor had the Holocaust had become as horrible as it had. It was just the first few years of Hitler had not yet come into the total driver's seat or had the final solution mapped out. So they were Zionists. My mother always had the blue plushka, the little box where you put your extra coins so that land could be acquired in Israel. They were very sympathetic and supportive of Israel. But in those times, at least until the end of World War II, nobody ever dreamed that the land would ever be restored to Jews. See, where was I before that? I'm glad you did.
We were talking about you sent your son to...
Yes. And then we had a very tight nucleus of Jewish friends in the View Ridge neighborhood, namely Professor Albert Schreiber, whose children were exactly the same age as mine, who taught in business administration on campus, Dr. Charles Kaplan, who was our pediatrician, lived two blocks away. Ludwig Loeb, who was a leader in the community, lived a block away. It sounds as though there were a lot of Jews in the neighborhood, but actually there was about a half a dozen families who were very close, socially and otherwise. And we felt dissatisfied with the services at Temple D. Hirsch. It was a very large, kind of cold congregation at the time, there again dominated by the German element. We weren't interested in orthodoxy, and Bichur Holim was a long way away, and Herzl was a long way away. Anyway, we started meeting in each other's homes on Friday night, and it was a very satisfying experience, primarily because we were giving of ourselves. And as more people became interested in it, we eventually rented a house for temporary quarters and raised enough money so that we could have a part-time rabbi who held down a job as a chaplain at Fort Lewis at the time. And Howard became 13, and he was the first bar mitzvah, and we called our congregation Temple Beth Am.
And this was when? Again?
Well, this, what year it was, you mean?
Yes.
Well, Howard is now 56, and he was 13 at the time, so we'd have to go back with a calculator. I'm sorry,
okay.
My figures
all
aren't
right.
Very good.
Okay.
We didn't have a building to have it. Rabbi Messing, the chaplain, trained him, and our service was held at the lovely little English-style university, Unitarian Church, on 15th Northeast, around 50th, Northeast 50th. It was a lovely small stone building. And that was the first bar mitzvah at our congregation, and the congregation has continued to thrive. And it was very satisfying for many years until it became so big that I don't know anybody anymore. And although I still maintain my membership as being a charter member, I think it took around 20 families to do that. I never go, period. Nor do I miss it.
And it's just
and I don't know anybody there anymore.
Well, I think that goes with getting on in years.
Right,
the same.
Right. And not having any kids to get the message to.
Right.
Because both of my children graduated the high school classes at Beth Am. So I sort of felt I did my duty. And I still feel I'm doing it because I'm still supporting it.
Good. And Jeanette, I know you've been active in various other organizations, Council of Jewish Women, and I don't know what I know. You've also been active in the general community, and I know that you were a docent, for example, at Seattle Art Museum.
Yeah. Well, some of my early volunteer efforts were through the National Council of Jewish Women, and at that time we had a number of programs at Neighborhood House, which was the renaming of Settlement House, which mm-hmm. had its early immigrant origins and its orientation had changed. Mm-hmm. And there were any number of programs that I participated in. Among community programs, I remember volunteering in the psychiatric wards at King County Hospital, now called Harborview Hospital, working with people who were emotionally disturbed mm-hmm. in a recreational sort of way. And
did you hold any office in the
yes,
council?
Yes, I was secretary of council and on the board for a number of years,
mm-hmm.
And did the usual things that one does in an organization that's devoted to social causes in the community.
Mm-hmm.
And I became a docent at the Seattle Art Museum about 27 years ago, and continued touring.
How did that come about? Can you remember?
Somebody I know whose name escapes me was a docent and thought that I might enjoy the avocation and might have something to contribute. And that is what started it. And that was long ago when the only building the art museum had was up at Bollinger Park. I was fortunate enough to travel widely, been many places in this world, and thought I had something to bring from the cultural point of view to art. And it's probably been one of the most enriching experiences
uh-huh.
of my life.
Uh-huh.
And I continue going to the classes, uh-huh. although I stopped touring a couple years ago when I was having a problem with a brain tumor and couldn't write anymore and had to have major surgery.
Uh-huh.
But I still go.
Wonderful.
Yeah.
Were you pioneering as far as, were there other Jewish docents at the time, or?
Mrs. Lachman, whose family ran large wholesale jewelry, was one of the active Jewish docents. They were definitely in a minority. And one of the other leaders in the group was the daughter of the man who ran Eckstein, Joanna Eckstein.
Joanna, yes.
Yes, who was not strongly identified with Jewish people, although through her father, Nathan Eckstein, a civic leader in the state as well as the
mm-hmm.
Seattle community, was a pillar at Temple D. Hirsch.
Mm-hmm.
But Joanna did mix broadly with a wider community
mm-hmm.
and took a lot of responsibility with the docents at that time.
Mm-hmm.
And I can't remember any other Jewish docents until a few mm-hmm. years later when more of them
were
started.
Were you conscious of it, that there were?
I never felt any emphasis
uh-huh.
on being Jewish among that circle of people.
Mm-hmm.
I had to admire the women who consistently give their services in that direction as being an unusual group of women, highly
mm-hmm.
intelligent, very dedicated, well educated.
Yes. Yes.
Still think it's a terrific group of people.
Mm-hmm. And you socialize freely with them, and
yeah. Well, not out. Not out. Oh yes, and all. Yes, never felt any
mm-hmm.
discrimination
yeah.
in the group.
Yeah.
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 Mm-hmm.
I've
rambled on for a long time.
No, well, it won't.
When do you want to quit?
Pretty soon.
Okay.
I know you've had enough. I know also that you're an avid golfer. You've played golf for many years. And
yes.
It
just so happened that my husband and one of our closest couple friends, Mr. and Mrs. Otto Rees. Otto, as well as my husband Walter, traveled a great deal in their respective businesses. And the two men were very generous and decided their wives would be better off to play golf than they would be patronizing a psychiatrist, because both of them were gone, although not continuously, but over the year, maybe as much as 6 months out of the year,
mm-hmm.
at which time all the problems of running a household and children fell upon both of us. So a very good outlet turned out to be golf. and they joined the membership at Glendale, although they never used the golf courses themselves. And I've been a member of Glendale probably 40 years and enjoyed golf. The club's character at that time and for many years thereafter was 100% Jewish, because non-Jews didn't care on the whole to be associated with a Jewish country club. However, Dr. Brown, who was a plastic surgeon in Seattle and who was black, was admitted to membership. And I dare say anyone else who was non-Jewish probably would have been had he chosen to be identified with the club. Mm-hmm. However, because more young people took a whole day off to play golf but turned instead to tennis, which took only a few hours and much less costly, and they would still have weekends for their family, didn't play golf. Mm-hmm. And as a consequence, some years ago, the club attracted non-Jewish members, and now the Jewish members.
How do you feel about it? Changes?
Everything else has become integrated. Why shouldn't a social club?
Okay.
Yeah, no strong feelings at all.
Uh-huh.
And if the leadership isn't there, and you have a costly institution to maintain, you don't have any choice.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Were you actively involved in the
Only so far as the women's group had their own organization,
mm-hmm.
and I was active in participating, you know, in the meetings and all.
Mm-hmm.
But there again, until relatively recently, women's voices didn't have much to say about it. Golf was a man's world at the time. But interestingly enough, women citywide in the private clubs were not allowed to play on Saturdays and Sundays because those were men's days. But the Jewish women at Glendale broke their husbands down on that before anybody else in the community. And women were allowed to play at Glendale at times that they weren't allowed to play in non-Jewish clubs.
Mm-hmm.
So we were sort of forerunners on that, and now I think it's changed in other clubs too.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And did you play in tournaments or win trophies or anything like that?
I won a few things, but was never a big golfer.
Oh, but you enjoyed it.
it's great. Good escapism and good exercise. And being outdoors has always been one of my pleasures.
Right. And I was curious if you just want to touch a little bit on Walter's business, and particularly
yes, my husband
unique
had,
business
yeah.
in Alaska. What did he start off with?
When Walter was brought to this country by a distant relative, you had to have someone who would give you what's called an affidavit, and it assured Uncle Sam that this individual would not become the public charge. And the person who gave him the affidavit was a leader in the Jewish community, a really wonderful man by the name of Max Silver.
Mm-hmm.
And Walter was put in charge of the souvenir department, and it was primarily originally the Hudson's Bay Fur Company, and had a prime location on Fifth Avenue between Pike and Pine, a very well-known store that had been started by Max Silver's father-in-law at the turn of the century, who actually traded the Indians for furs.
Who was Max?
His father-in-law was Gutman, Addis Gutman Sr. I'm not sure Addis was his first name.
Mm-hmm.
His son was Addis Gutman, but I don't know what the father was. And in encountering Indians and purchasing furs, he bought Indian baskets and Indian carvings like totem poles and potlatch bowls and that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And on the second floor of the business, he started a museum, and just a museum in connection with that. And eventually he built up a fine collection, and word got around, and some American museum curators came to him and bought baskets and totem poles and stuff. As the years went by, there was less of this kind of item. Fewer Indians knew how to carve. Our government, unlike the Canadian government, didn't foster classes for young North Coast Indians promoting their handcraft, and it eventually became a dying art. At any rate, Mr. Silver and his brother-in-law, Addis Gutman, had a couple of sons, each of them, and Walter and another employee who had left the firm had an eye to the future and realized that when the war was over, the company, I might add, at that time had contracts to make Arctic parkas for our troops that had been trained for warfare in Arctic regions. And these parkas were lined, I remember, with Arctic wolf. And Walter worked in on those garments during the war. And the man who had left the company about the time of Walter's arrival thought that there would be a market for souvenirs, North Coast souvenirs. And he and his wife had started a home industry, Bert Mayers was his name, of making Indian dolls, Indian and Eskimo dolls. And there was a ready market among the tourist trade. So they both started the company and called it Indian Arts and Crafts, and originally went in primarily for genuine Indian artifacts. But there was not sufficient volume for that. So they branched into other aspects of the souvenir trade, you know, like photograph albums, souvenir spoons, on and on and on and on. Almost anything that had the state of Washington or Seattle or some other identification on it. And it eventually developed into a large business. And when my son graduated University of Michigan, he knew that he would always go into his father's business. And I can remember my son, who was over in Vietnam for 14 months, met his father in Hong Kong on one of his R&Rs, and went around with him to meet his suppliers, with an eye to knowing that if he were able, if he did get back from the war, which fortunately he did, he would someday be meeting him on a business-like basis. And he continued running the business after his father's death, expanding it, and finally sold it to a NASDAQ company.
And so I know Walter spent quite a bit of time then, and I imagine Howard too, in traveling to Alaska.
Alaska was a major source of our livelihood. He was a pioneer in traveling that area, had tremendous loyalty on the part of his clients because he was such a fair businessman, and everyone knew that reputation. I can remember in the years when Walter went up there, there were no waiting rooms, especially in the Arctic area, for the passengers. But they would have fans out on the field to keep the engines from icing up, and temperatures, in, especially around Fairbanks, were 45 below. And he really was a pioneer in traveling Alaska in those years. That was immediately after World War II.
Yeah. Did you ever go up on any of those trips?
Yes, when Howard was in college and before he came back to take his share of the load after the Vietnamese War, I went up several times with Walter to see the countryside and help.
Do you still have any connections or with the some of your suppliers up there? Or
well, those would have all, they would have all expired. Howard still does, because after all, he left the business now probably about 6 years ago.
Yeah.
Although I would have to think.